Buddhist philosophy speaks of the four invisibles: water to the fish, air to the bird, mind to mankind, and enlightenment to the ignorant. Because you see, you never know your own element. Now, it's impossible, therefore, to give a definition of consciousness, because we don't know anything outside it, just as the fish doesn't know anything outside water, and the bird doesn't know anything outside air. We don't know unconsciousness. We only know when we have been unconscious. And so, we are in a very difficult fix to attempt to define the subject of this seminar. We all know what it is, and yet none of us know what it is. We know we're conscious. It's the same sort of problem as to try to say what color your eyes are. I don't mean whether they're blue or brown, but the color of the iris, the lens of the eye. Because we say it has no color, it's transparent, it's like pure glass. And yet, that might be a color to somebody who had a different kind of eye. An Englishman and a Hindu were once sitting in the backyard of the Hindu's home, and the Hindu was talking about the necessity of a background for the perception of any figure. So he said, against what background do you see those flowers? And he said, against the background of the hedge. And against what background do you see the hedge? He said, the background of the hills. And against what background do you see the hills? He said, the background of the sky. And he said, and against what background do you see the sky? And the Englishman fell silent. The Hindu said, it's the background of consciousness. But there you see, we reach a limit. And you can talk until all is blue about whether consciousness and reality are the same thing, whether there really is ever any such thing as pure unconsciousness, whether consciousness is eternal, whether, as the subjective idealists would say in philosophy, there is primarily mind, and all so-called physical and material existence is something in mind or something in consciousness. You can debate that subject forever and ever and ever and come out nowhere. There is no answer to the question when asked in that way. But it is helpful as a start to make things at once more simple and perhaps a little more difficult by overcoming at the beginning the traditional opposition between the spiritual and the material, or the mental and the material. By the trick of talking about all things, whether spiritual or physical, in terms of pattern. Because that's all anybody can really talk about, pattern. You see, it's fundamental to our common sense, which was highly influenced by Aristotle and the book of Genesis, that all forms are composed of some substance, in roughly the same way as sculptures are made of stone or pots made of clay. But a serious physicist no longer thinks in such terms about the material world. He doesn't think it's made of anything. Because what the physical process of nature is patterns. You could say patterns of energy, but that's using the old ceramic language. Patterns aren't made of energy. The patterning is the same thing as the energy. So if you use the verb patterning as what the universe is, then you get something that you can talk about. You can describe patterns, you can measure them. you can say what a pattern is doing, although a pattern isn't a thing. A pattern is a verb, it is a process, it's an activity. So we can say patterning is what is going on. And consciousness is a kind of patterning, as we shall see. Just so are flowers and human beings and stars, trees, water, air, everything, even space itself, is a form of patterning. And this means, in other words, that the universe is what physicists would call an energy field. And likewise, consciousness is a field. In the sense, say, that space is obviously a field. That is to say, an area in which things happen. That's the primary meaning of field. A field is a playing field, a field in which something happens, like an arena. Only when you use the word field in more in the sense of physics, you mean a field of forces, like a magnetic field, like a gravitational field. And the curious thing about fields is that they exercise their energy in a non-mechanical way. For example, if gravity were non-field, that is to say, if it were the ordinary sort of exercise of energy, like the propagation of heat, or like someone pulling, then when you put something on the ground, you put a good heavy lead plate on the ground, that would be absorbing so much gravitational energy, and therefore anything you put on top of the plate would be less acted upon by gravity than the lead plate itself, and then anything on top of that would be still less, and you would reduce the energy of gravity by piling things up. But you don't. It doesn't make the slightest difference to the gravitational field. So in the same way, if you take an electrical coil, say surrounding a plastic tube, you can put a current through that, and you create a field within the tube. You can put your hand inside the tube, and nothing will happen to it. But the minute you put something that is like steel inside the tube, it will get hot. But no heat will be generated until the steel is inside the tube, because the coil plus the steel equals heat. But the coil has to polarize with the steel inside before anything happens at all. So that shows us that what is operating is a field. Now, think then of the world as a field characterized by patterning, which for which another name is energy. And we are going to have to treat consciousness in rather the same way. Now, one thing that is characteristic of all energies, all energies whatsoever, all patterning whatsoever, is that we find it convenient to think about it in terms of the spectrum. So there is a spectrum of light. The visible spectrum running from red to violet, and beyond the visible spectrum, there is a very big invisible spectrum, because our eyes respond only to a small section of the measurable spectrum of light. So we have infrared rays at one end and ultraviolet at the other, and then so on out to cosmic rays, gamma rays, hard X-rays, all sorts of things on the invisible bands of the spectrum. So in exactly the same way, there is a spectrum of sound. And if anybody was a sufficient scientist of cookery, they would devise a spectrum of taste. There are certainly spectra of other kinds of vibration than sound and light. And there are likewise conceivable spectra of shapes, spectra of emotions. So we could talk too of a spectrum of love, ranging at the red end from lust or the Freudian libido to divine love at the violet end, divine charity. And in the middle greens would be things like friendship and endearment, and so on. Each emotion, as a matter of fact, could be thought of as having its own spectrum. Now then, the curious thing about the world is that it's a kind of interlocking of spectra, of which the best analogy would be weaving. The interesting thing about weaving is that you've got the two cross groups of cross threads which give you the pattern, the warp and the woof. And if you pull out either one, there is no pattern, nor is there any cloth. It all falls apart. It needs both the warp and the woof for there to be any pattern at all. And they together constitute the cloth. Now let's look at a similar illustration in the ordinary everyday world of this interlocking of patterns. Let's take the photograph of a face in a newspaper. If you examine this photograph under a magnifying glass, or even with the naked eye, you will easily see that it isn't a continuous face, as faces are supposed to be, but it is a whole collection of dots. Some are heavy, some are light. And according to the heaviness and lightness, as you stand back, you get, as it were, the illusion of there being present, in terms of those dots, a human face. Now let me pose the question. What is the relationship between the form of the face and the gridwork of dots? At first sight, there doesn't seem to be any relationship between them at all, because the printer uses exactly the same kind of screen with which this process is done for any face whatsoever. So the kind of screen he uses makes no difference at all to whose face it is. Anybody's face can be on it, or any other shape. So you might say the fact that he is using a grid is completely irrelevant to the form of the face. Take still another illustration, the radio. When you turn on your radio and it comes on first thing in the morning, the announcer does not say, the sounds you are now hearing are vibrations of a diaphragm activated by electromagnetism. This is mediated to you through a network of transistors and a broadcasting station with such and such features. He just does not intrude the mechanics of radio. He comes right on saying, this is station so-and-so, welcome, this is this morning's news, or whatever he begins with. So it would seem that the structure of the radio, the wiring, the transistors, the speaker, have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the message that's coming across it. They are in two different worlds altogether, so it would seem. Then take another possibility. What about the brain? Is thought, emotion, or consciousness itself a function of the brain? If we knew a great deal about the anatomy of the brain, would that tell us a great deal about the patterns of human thinking? Or would it tell us as little about the patterns of human thinking as knowledge of radio engineering tells you about the technique of Bach, whom you hear over the radio? See, there's a real puzzle. And this is one of the interesting subjects brought out in this extraordinary book called Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan. And I don't think he's clearly answered it, because he is trying to say that what is most important is not so much the message or what is supposed to be the content of any method of extending our nervous system, such as radio, such as television, such as printing, such as photography. He is trying to say that the message is the medium. That is to say, you are influenced by television, not so much by the advertising and all the goop that comes across on it, but by the fact of being in touch with the world through this particular electronic system with all its peculiarities. It's a very interesting idea, and he's put up an argument for it, but I'm I'm not convinced that his argument is quite solid. But I want to go into this question, because obviously you would not hear any music except you had an orchestra in your room, were it not for your radio or your phonograph. And as a matter of fact, even if you had an orchestra in your room, you wouldn't get them to produce any music without those instruments. Now, let me ask the question in another way. What is the relationship between the piano and what you play on it? Any? You can play anything practically on a piano, and the structure of the piano doesn't make any difference. And yet without it, you couldn't play. So we've never seen anybody thinking without a brain. So what is the relationship between them? Well, again, you see, it's rather like warp and woof. The warp goes one way, and the woof goes the other. But by the interlocking of the two, you get something. So what you've got then are spectra of different kinds. See, when you dial and you move the dial, what you're doing is you're changing the wavelength of your radio. That is to say, you are moving from one end of the spectrum of waves slowly to the other. So the spectrum of radio meshes with another spectrum which is being used in the production of music. As a matter of fact, the production of music is an interlocking of many spectra, but we won't go into that because the emotional spectra are involved. Spectra of speed, of dexterity, of harmonics, all kinds of things go into this. So you get the picture of the world as an enormous web where spectra mesh with spectra of all kinds, and they're all mutually interdependent, and through them it all hangs together. And the peculiar fact of these spectra is that they come in together, come into being together almost. The world is not, you don't see things appearing in nature except from with certain insects and birds that actually practice weaving. But you don't see plants and trees being exactly woven. What seems to happen more than that is that warp and woof come into being together at the same time, in rather the same way that back and front necessarily come into being together at the same time. Or head and tail. You don't see a creature born as a head and then later developing a neck, a trunk, feet, and tail. It just doesn't work that way. It comes in together, head and tail. Even the spermatozoan has a head and a tail. So then, what I want to go into, of course, is the spectrum of consciousness and its many transformations. The different range, the huge range of the spectrum is extraordinarily fascinating. So then, but let me first be sure that we are quite clear about this physical conception of the world. You see, you can also call these spectra, if you want to, dimensions. And dimensions is a very useful idea. You can see that you can't have a physical existence in terms of point, line, surface. Each of those is a dimension. It's not till you get the so-called third dimension, although it should correctly be called the fourth, and time the fifth. It's not till you get the so-called third dimension that anything is physically manifested. Then you're there. Now you could say these dimensions are quite different from each other. A surface is a very different thing from a line, as is a line from a point. But somehow they all go with each other in a way that we don't normally think of as a kind of... in other words, dimensions don't seem to bear the same sort of relationship to each other as do opposites. At least not in our ordinary thinking. We think that opposites are mutually exclusive, and that you can't have something that is hot and cold at the same time. It's either hot or cold. But dimensions are not mutually exclusive. Dimensions are always dimensions of the same field or the same thing. And so then you have to think, therefore, of what we've hitherto called the mental and the physical, the spiritual and the material, as dimensions of the same thing. Dimensions of patterning, dimensions of energy. So then you've got this fantastic universe with all these interlocking spectra and dimensions. And this, of course, is the real harp that the angels play. When they talk about you going to heaven and playing the harp, what are you doing? You've got a spectrum of strings, see? And from that, though, when you play the harp, you don't play all the strings at once. So that'd be just chaos, like when you play the piano. Just don't take your elbows like this and slam the whole thing down. You select. So throughout nature, all these spectra that are interlocked are being selected from. That is why the eyes select only a narrow band of the spectrum of light, while the ears select a narrow band only of the spectrum of sound. And further than that, by the use of attention, we screen out all sorts of things we don't want to notice. Our senses are further selective, you see, by influence by thought. And so this is analogous to plucking the strings of a harp, where you make choices as to which strings you will pluck. So when the angels play their harp, the music is everything you see. So that's the real meaning of what you do in heaven when you go and play the harp. You become one with God and you create the universe, you see. That's the real meaning. Well, now, what about the spectrum of consciousness? I'm going to designate... I couldn't avoid it. I tried to, but I couldn't. A sevenfold spectrum. that's number seven is awkward. Every kind of phony occultist is hung up on seven. And I wanted to get away from that, but I just somehow couldn't manage it. So... let's take it like this. We're going, you see, from one end, the most dull dimension of consciousness, or band of consciousness, and landing up at the other end at the brightest. So you begin with number one, which is sleep. And of course there are two kinds of sleep. Dreamless. And dreaming. Number two is torpor. As in the state of going to sleep or under the influence of alcohol, you feel no pain at all, or you're sort of anesthetized and your senses are dull and blurred and you don't feel like being very active. Three, waking consciousness. Only I have to qualify this because the others are awake too. But I mean our normal, everyday consciousness, which we're going to call symbolic. And I'll explain why as we go through these in detail. Number four, sensory consciousness. Number five, cellular. Number six, molecular. And number seven, we'll just give the name light to it. Now, I want to make it perfectly clear that these names that I have used are not claiming to be exact scientific names. They are simply suggestive. We do not yet have a science of consciousness in the sense, the Western sense of science. It doesn't exist. And that's one of the things we shall eventually have to do. So these names are rather symbolic names than exactly scientific names, and you must keep that in mind. Now, it's rather interesting that this particular spectrum should best be drawn not on the usual way a spectrum is drawn, which is simply a band, but it should be drawn as a circle of which each of these is, as it were, a cut in the pie. So that beyond here is again sleep. Deep sleep, dreamless sleep. Because you know the Hindus have a way of classifying the states of consciousness, which isn't quite the same as this. They start out with number one, this one. The waking state. Then they take number two, the dreaming state. Number three, the dreamless state, and number four, this one, which is called Turiya simply, which means the fourth, and which cannot be described. And they would say that when you go to bed at night, you sink first into the dreaming state, then you go down into what they call Sushupti, the dreamless state, and you may get back into the fourth, and that is why sleep refreshes you. Because you as an individual are withdrawn into the center of the universe, into the Atman, or the Brahman, the primordial reality, the ground of being, to use Tillich's phrase, which he got from Jacob Burma. And so that's why you are refreshed every night. There you know who you are, really, deep in. Because, as the Hindus teach, everybody is really it. That is to say, the Godhead. Playing at being, dreaming at being, whoever is your particular personality. And then it's only at night, then, when you sleep, that you go back again to being the undivided, one and only single essence of the universe. Only when you wake up, you forget about it. Why? Because in the primordial state, there's nothing to remember. There's no time. And you have to have time working for memory to work. So imagine then this thing as a circle, where, say, at the top of the circle you have number seven, brilliant, and then the colors of consciousness going right round and meeting again here, here and here. So you kind of have black and white next to each other at the top, if we'll put this in terms of color. And then all the other colors, connecting them all the way around. Because, of course, you see, black and white, as I will show you later on in the seminar, are astonishingly creative. You can do everything with black and white. Black and white really contain all color. And this is why the Chinese theory of the universe is based on the opposition of the yang and the yin, the positive and negative. The names yang and yin are derived respectively from the north and the south sides of a mountain. This is the primordial image. The yang is the south side of the mountain, which is bright. The yin is the north side of the mountain, which is in the shadow. Now, nobody ever saw a one-sided mountain. Can't be such a thing. So in the same way, you cannot have yang without yin. The symbol of the yang yin, you know well, I don't even need to draw it. The two interlocked commas, one black, one white, and each with the opposite color as its eye, so that they look like two fishes chasing each other. This is a very profound symbol, because the idea which goes with it is this, that yang and yin are a wave process, where the yin aspect is the crest and the yang aspect is the trough. And likewise, in the same way as you can't have a one-sided hill, you can't have half a wave. Half a wave doesn't exist anywhere in nature. There are no half waves of light, no half waves of sound. There are always complete waves, or none. Because you cannot have the crest without the trough, and you can't have the trough without the crest. It just won't work. Now, however, there is a pulse in this. There is a point where the yang force reaches an ascendancy and then begins to drop into the yin, where the yin force reaches an ascendancy and begins to rise into the yang. And the Chinese are always thinking about this in relation to tendencies in natural and human affairs, where, for example, the yang force of a storm will reach a peak point where it must drop over into the yin force of calm, where the whole book of changes, they call the Yi Jing, is based on this. The Yi Jing is a marvelous play with yang and yin. You see, just let me say this about it in parenthesis. When you want to make a decision, and you've got all the facts in, at least all the facts you could have got time to collect, because you could go on collecting facts about any decision forever, but the time comes when you have to make it. And you say, now I've got all the facts, and they really don't help me to decide. Because I might go one way and I might go the other. Let's flip a coin. And everybody's always doing that. But you see, a coin only gives you two possibilities. Two answers. Either the thing answers yes or no. So the Chinese have a coin, as it were, to flip, which gives you 64 possibilities. And you take one of them. And it doesn't give you a yes or no answer. It gives you a kind of a thing like a Rorschach blot, really. It doesn't look like a Rorschach blot, but that's what it is. Into which you read your situation and make up your mind accordingly. And this is done, you see, by combining the yang and the yin in a complex pattern. The I Ching consists of hexagrams. And they are composed of two kinds of lines. An unbroken line, like this, is a yang or positive line. And a broken line, like this, is a yin or negative line. Then, there you've got them. Now, there are, if you take a figure with three lines, which we'll call a trigram, see? There are eight ways of making such a trigram with yang and yin lines. This one happens to mean fire. No, water. No, fire, excuse me. Fire. Two positive and one negative in the middle. Now, if you've got eight trigrams was the possibility of making out of those 8 trigrams 64 hexagrams. So this one would be water, and you'd get one which was fire and water together. See? So to each of those, the Book of Changes attaches an oracular remark. And if you look up the book, when you've, by a certain process, got your hexagram, it gives you some light on your decision and the direction it should take by bringing it out of you by its remarks, in the same way as a Rorschach blot brings out your psychological disposition. So that's 64 ways of tossing a coin. If you had a 64-sided coin, you could do it that way. If you could make such a thing, you probably could. It would be spherical. So, from yang and yin, from the extremes of polarity, because you see, light is as intensely alive as you can get. But if you go too far into light, it'll burn you up, and you'll get darkness. But people don't know, they don't realize that the farthest you can get into darkness, it'll start getting bright. Because you can't have darkness without light any more than you can have light without darkness. So when we were babies, we were never told this. And it's the secret that the light and dark go together. It is the only real secret there is. Black and white. But what we've forgotten the secret, because with black and white we're playing another game, which is called, black might win. See, that's what makes everything a thrill. If you knew you would always win in any situation, it would be just a pushover, and life would suddenly cease to have any interest whatsoever. You would be, imagine yourselves in total control of everything that happens, a kind of Jehovah type. You would be bored to death. Just everything would do just what, no surprises, nothing. You see, when in a game, you're playing a game, and the outcome of the game becomes known, supposing in the course of bridge, the four players all suddenly realize together that one of them has all the cards that will take the tricks. What do? They don't play the game. They cancel it and begin again, shuffle the pack. When in chess, two pundits are sitting there meditating, one of them suddenly says, well, it's obvious, in 53 moves you're going to win. They cancel the game. So in the same way, an omniscient God who knew the whole future would cancel the universe and say, think up another. So it is fundamental to the game of black and white that it must seem that black will win and eat up white. That, in other words, non-existence will triumph over existence. Or rather, let me put it this way, non-being will triumph over being. Because the secret is that existence is being and non-being, oscillating. So that for every time you get being, you get non-being. Just as everything is vibration. And these spectra are vibrations. Light is vibration. If I sit next to a girl at the movies and I want to make flirtations with her, and I put my hand on her knee, and I leave it there, she'll cease to notice it. But if I gently pat her knee, she'll know I'm there all the time, because I go on and off, on and off, on and off, on and off, on and off. And that is energy, you see. That's something happening. And so everything is on-off. Only sometimes on-off happens so fast that you don't notice the off. For example, light is a pulsation, but all light seems to be constant. And so we don't notice the off because our retina is retaining the image of on while the off is happening in the light. So we don't notice the off. Except if you get an arc light, you can notice a little flicker to it. And that's why they don't allow arc lights in sawmills. Because sometimes the flickering of the arc light can synchronize with the movement of the teeth on the saw in such a way that the saw seems to be still when it's actually moving, and people get very serious accidents that way. But everything is on-off. Now then, sometimes, you see, we don't notice the off, but at other times we don't notice the on. And that is when we're asleep, when, in other words, or when we're dead, when the trough, the off section, takes a long spin. Because, you see, there are big vibrations and little vibrations. Some vibrations happen so fast that we can't measure them. Others happen so slowly that it takes a century. It may take a million years for a single swoop of the curve that goes down or that makes the upcrest of the wave. You see, when you look at the wave pattern, you must realize that the crest is measured from the top to the middle of each trough, and that the trough is measured from the top of each crest to the bottom of the trough. They overlap. So if you can argue it's all trough, and you can argue it's all crest, it's a funny world. So the argument that it's all trough, and that maybe just a little bit of crest, about poing, like that, poing, these are the people who say, well, we are flashes in an eternal darkness. It's a pessimistic point of view. And then there are the people who say there really is no death at all. Death is just an illusion that seems to happen. This is the optimistic point of view. And the optimistic point of view is essential to the pessimistic, as the pessimistic is essential to the optimistic. Because you wouldn't know who you were, you see, if you didn't have both points of view. I'm not going to see, and when I teach, I don't try to persuade anybody. And everybody's at liberty to disagree, because I wouldn't know what I was thinking unless there were people to disagree with me. So in the same way, supposing you're in a social scene, like here in La Jolla, there are nice people, and there are not so nice people. There are various kinds of nice people, various kinds of not so nice people. There are, for example, nice people who belong to the country club set. There are nice people who belong to the arty set. Nice people who belong to the social service set, and so on. And then there are nasty people who may variously be defined as the poor, or the beatniks, the generally disrespectable people who live on the wrong side of the track, or the wrong part of the hill, or whatever it is, or the wrong town. And but the nice people boost and maintain their collective ego by talking about how dreadful the nasty people are. And the nasty people boost their collective ego by talking about what frightful bourgeois squares the nice people are. But they don't, neither group realize it, that they have a symbiotic relationship, just like bees and flowers. Only, whereas the bee-flower relationship is harmonious, the symbiosis of differing social groups is disharmonious. Because each group needs the other to know who it is. Because if you were the only kind of people there were, you wouldn't know who you were. See, in a totally conformist society, someone sitting next to you is just like you, so there's no point talking to him. Because you might just as well talk to yourself. In other words, really and truly, to be yourself, you need other. You don't know what you mean by self unless you know what you mean by other. So this is how yang and yin, the polarities, generate everything. And are absolutely essential to each other. Now, the funny thing is this. If you belong to a certain group of saved or elected people, and you know you're saved and elect because of the damned people outside, whether this is a social salvation, a spiritual salvation, or any kind of salvation you want to think of, financial salvation, whatever, when you realize that you only know who you are because of the, as it were, adversary or enemy or outgroup, you start laughing. Because that's very funny. It's the contrast from suddenly thinking, you know, wow, those bastards outside, and suddenly realizing that they are enabling you to take this pose of coming on tough, which you think is great. And you start laughing. And this is why society, as we now know it, is afraid of this ever getting let out. This is real, really subversive. This is terrible subversive stuff. I mean, all that Marxist is just the same thing as us backwards. It's the collectivist idea of the state as opposed to the individualist idea of the state. But the individualists become collectivists through huge corporations. Lenin said he would love to see these great corporations growing up because it would be just so much easier for the state to take over. They'd already provided the organization. So you see, there is a tendency within our economy to become a collectivist economy just by progressing with its own whatever it's doing, with its so-called free enterprise. And there will be naturally, therefore, be a tendency in a collective economy to fall apart because it all gets so boring and start everybody out on his own initiative again. This thing goes round and round. But the important thing is that, supposing you believe in a free enterprise economy, you must have, in order to maintain your solidarity, especially in a very great country, you must have an external enemy. And if there wasn't one, you'd have to invent one. Because that keeps everybody on their toes, it keeps us from slacking on the job, and they say, got to beat those fellows. And they're terrible. So we've got to be very serious about that, see? Are we? And of course, you lose your sense of humor. When you get so serious, you don't really know underneath that it's a game. Then you become a bircher on one extreme or a communist on the other. So you have to keep, if you want to be a sane human being, you have to know right in the back of your head, right back here, what the Germans call a Hintergedanke, which is way in the back of your mind. You have to see the point that enemies need each other, cops and robbers. Where would the cops be for a job if there weren't any robbers? How would you know you were law-abiding if there weren't criminals? It's tricky, but it's very dangerous teaching. Very subversive, because you might think, I would say, if I realized that, well, I said, it simply doesn't matter what kind of a person I am. And do anything I want, because evil is necessary to good. But there's no fun in that attitude, because that simply says, I won't play. All right, if you want to sit by yourself under a tree and not play, I guess you could do that, provided you don't interfere with our game. And if you come and interfere with our game and say, well, now look here, you people, you're all wrong, you know, because you think you ought to be good, but it doesn't matter whether you're good or not, you see. You mustn't do that. Don't interfere with the game. In order to have this kind of knowledge, that's why all this kind of knowledge has always been esoteric. And in any esoteric school, people were tested first, before they got in order to find out whether you were civilized. In other words, you can't give powerful tools and powerful knowledge to people who aren't civilized and who have no humor and who have no graciousness. That's why it's difficult when young people get hold of knowledge that is for which they're not emotionally prepared. And they are given full and total instruction on birth control when they're 4 years old. It means nothing at all. Or it may mean something positively dangerous. But nowadays, there's no way of concealing these things. I said it's a secret, but in the world of science, there are no secrets. So I don't feel any compunction about talking about these things, because if I don't, somebody else is going to. Because an awful lot of people know about it. But that is the inside dope, if I may say so. That these extremes need each other and can't manifest without each other. And the point is how to keep your head when you know that. So let's have an intermission.